This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Flashback Friday edition of the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. As he rapidly approaches 1,000 episodes of this podcast, he has handpicked individual episodes that he feels is going to be good review for you to prepare you for the future by listening to the past. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
This is your host, Jason Hartman. Thanks for joining me today. We are going to talk about mortgage financing today. We're going to talk about four different areas of mortgages here in just a moment. Couple very quick announcements. Number one, join us for IRA investing seminar. Again, you know, the laws have changed and there's a good new opportunity going on with Roth IRA conversions and investing in real estate with your IRA right now. That event is a free event and a light luncheon will be provided. It's Wednesday, December 9th, here at our office in Costa Mesa, California, 11:30 a.m. sharp, ending at 1 p.m. It's going to be a very quick presentation because of the lunch hour. Also, Creating Wealth Bootcamp on January 23rd and the Masters Weekend on March 6th and 7th. And there we're talking about 2010. If you want tax write-offs for this year, buy your properties now. You've only got a little time left. You got to be able to close by the end of the year. So be quick about it. Business is booming in a lot of our areas right now. We have high activity, and we are finding it a little bit tough to get inventory. Properties, when they're going up on our website, they're selling very quickly, so be sure to talk with one of our investment counselors here at Platinum Properties Investor Network about that. Also, I want to make sure, I haven't talked about it much lately, folks, but you have got to subscribe to the Financial Freedom Report. That is our newsletter. I'm holding the new edition in front of me now. It's 20 pages long, and I tell you, there's some phenomenal information in here. So you can subscribe. It's only $197 a year via email, $297 a year via print, and go to jasonhartman.com and go to the store. And even the world's cutest dog, my dog, Puppy, he writes a column in there a lot of the time. So you'll really enjoy that. There's a fantastic flow chart, by the way, on the front page that talks about paying the man. And it talks about the financial situation we're in now and which way it may lead, whether we're going to see inflation, deflation, price stability, monetary tightening, monetary loosening, and how that affects your investments in income property, stocks, bonds, savings, whatever else. So the newsletter, the Financial Freedom Report, is awesome. I have not mentioned it much lately. Be sure you subscribe. You need to get yourself a copy of that and get a regular subscription. If I don't talk to you before, but I think I will, I want to wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving for all of our American listeners. And let's go to the interview now with Randy. You've heard him on the show before. And we're going to talk about four important aspects of mortgage financing. Our next show, we have Nancy talking about internet marketing. And then after that, we have Mike Munger, politician from South Carolina, former gubernatorial candidate. And I think you'll really like his show. Very interesting. So we're going to keep talking about how you can gain financial freedom through solopreneurship businesses, very small micro businesses, being a micropreneur, as we call it, and having home-based internet marketing type businesses, and America's most historically proven investment, and that, of course, is income property. So that's what the Creating Wealth Show is all about, creating income and creating wealth. So let's listen in. Let's talk about mortgages today. And here's the interview with Randy.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
You've heard him on the show before. It's my pleasure to welcome back our mortgage expert, Randy Lubke. Randy, welcome.
Thanks, Jason. Glad to be here.
Tell us, what is the temperature of the lending market today? Things are still crazy out there.
They still are. If you recall back a year ago, when the idea was that the banks were too big to fail and the government had to step in and do this bailout money, what's interesting is to fast forward to today and realize that they've now created, what, two, three, or four really big banks that really can't fail. I think that's a good place to start from. And inside that, what I'm seeing on a day-to-day basis is everything is as strict as it's ever been, if not more so than ever. And we have literally no flexibility or latitude in terms of varying from the guidelines whatsoever.
So the guidelines are strict. Are they overcorrecting, Randy? Are they too strict? I mean, they were too loosey-goosey before, for sure.
The answer is that the guidelines are not any different than they were, say, back in the late 80s. The difference is that there's no variation from the guidelines. So if we have, for example, a 50% debt-to-income ratio, and that's the maximum, and it can't be one penny over, it won't happen.
What's going on in the world of disclosures when it comes to lending?
Well, that's another big change that's happened recently, and it's people that are buying properties are going to be mostly affected by it. It's really a timing thing, and the idea is this, that when you take a loan application with us, we have a certain amount of days before we need to send out the initial disclosures to tell you what the interest rate is and the terms and the various costs and fees associated with the loan.
That's the truth in lending disclosure?
The truth in lending disclosure and the good faith estimate.
All right.
Of closing costs, okay? So in the past, what we were able to do is meet with a borrower, take their loan application, and we were in agreement with the terms at that initial meeting. We'd be able to go right ahead, order their credit report, order their appraisal, and get the ball rolling. Well, what's happened recently is they put a stop to that, where now we have to actually wait 4 business days before we're able to order an appraisal on the property. And if there's any significant changes, any material changes, which by the way means if the interest rate on the APR, the annual percentage rate, changes as little as 1/8%, we have to redisclose again. And the soonest you'd be able to sign loan documents would be 7 business days after that.
But that wouldn't be that much of a problem usually because the loan needs to be processed. But in the front of the transaction, what goes on? Because you said you have to wait 4 days to order the appraisal?
That's right.
What's the big deal? What's the rationale there? I don't get it.
The rationale is when we order appraisals nowadays, we are going to collect a fee from the borrower to pay for the appraisal.
Oh, so what you're saying is that they don't want you charging the fee until they've been disclosed the terms.
That's correct.
So if a borrower is shopping, then they can talk to 3 different people, get 3 different good faiths before paying for an appraisal.
Before paying for the appraisal.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, it's not that big a deal.
Well, and the big deal, you mentioned not a closing because of the processing time, but the truth of the matter is we used to work with our borrowers, and you could literally wait till you're ready to draw loan documents to choose what points and fee structure you wanted to have with your loan or choose which loan program you wanted to go with, 15-year, 30, or whatever. Not anymore. If they make a change to that loan program that affects the APR, it's a 7-day wait before we can get the loan documents out to close escrow.
Oh, that is a big deal.
It is.
I take back what I said then, because what you're saying is that it makes it hard for the buyer to switch products.
Yes.
During the purchase transaction. So here again, I would assume that the government, in all their infinite stupidity, is trying to help the consumer. And they may actually, in some cases, be hurting the consumer, no?
I think they are. I think you're
hitting. They are which one?
I think they're doing what you said in the latter. They're doing exactly what you say. Government wants to come in and protect the consumer.
Right.
They don't want consumers to get locked down and pay upfront fees, which makes sense. But in the process of doing this, is that law of unintended consequences, now they're going to cause delays to escrow when the borrower, for legitimate reasons, would like to change loan programs or pay more or less points on a loan.
And you can see that sometimes, as you've dealt with hundreds of times over the many years you've been in the business, sometimes the rate is going to change, and maybe you're in a market where the rates are trending up, and the buyer wants to switch horses, do this different program, a new program came available, and you can't switch them without violating the rules.
Yeah, well, you can't violate the rules, we have to wait 7 days. The violation isn't going to happen.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I mean, not that you would violate the rules, yeah. But you can't switch them. Yeah. Wow. Okay. There we go again, government and all their wisdom.
Another thing just to bring up is appraisals. In the past, of course, we had relationships with appraisers in local markets.
And now it's appraisal management companies.
Now it's appraisal management companies.
And this is really a seismic shift in the industry, I think. And I've read a lot about it, and you can see the rationale behind it.
Absolutely.
They don't want you guys influencing the appraiser, right?
Absolutely.
They don't want the realtor influencing the appraiser. They don't want the lender influencing the appraiser. There were too many abuses there, right?
Well, you know, I don't know how many abuses there were, but certainly there were abuses.
Right.
Right. And that's the issue. You know, we maybe strong arm an appraiser to give us a value. But if you flip flop it and go to where we are today, now the way they choose an appraiser is from these appraisal management companies who have a pool of appraisers that are, you know, licensed appraisers, and they're qualified.
But it's a blind pool. You don't know which appraiser will be going to that property, right?
Which I don't have a problem with that. What I do have a problem with is the way they actually choose the appraisal. And
okay.
it's like a reverse eBay.
Okay.
Meaning.
Oh, it's an auction. It's a reverse auction.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us how that works.
Well, basically, if the appraisal fee is, say, $500, and I'm an appraiser, I'm willing to do it for $4, and the next guy willing to do it for $350, and the next guy's willing to do it for $3, and so on and so forth. Do you see where I'm going with this? What you end up with is potentially the person who is the least qualified to do the appraisal.
The lowest bidder.
The lowest bidder. The least busy, the least need, the least valuable, and not necessarily a requirement that they even be familiar with that particular market.
But that reverse auction scenario isn't legislated, right? That can't be legislated that way. That's just the way these appraisal management companies, they're becoming like the lending tree for appraisers.
Well, and they get the spread between the cost of the appraisal and what they can actually get a bid out for.
Let me just explain, if I may, and
sure.
I'm sure you want to add to this, what happened here. So back in the day, in the old days, which was only 8-10 months ago,
That's right.
What would happen is appraisers would develop relationships with lenders, with mortgage brokers, with mortgage bankers, and they would come in to the office and they would call on them and schmooze them for business, if you will, and maybe bring them a bottle of wine or some cookies or bagels or whatever.
You never got that?
I know appraisers that did that.
Yeah.
You know, these mortgage companies were giving them business. And so their interest was to, their client ostensibly was not the borrower, it was the mortgage company. Okay,
yeah,
so this is just how it worked. I'm just explaining it. They would schmooze the mortgage company to get business, and then when there was an appraisal that would come up here and there where it was hard to bring in the value, the mortgage company might, in some cases, exert some pressure on the appraiser, say, hey, you got to bring this in so I can get my deal closed. And what would happen there is the value would be artificially high. That was the abuse.
That was the abuse. But if you think of it, again, once the appraisal goes from the lender to the underwriter's desk, the underwriter is supposed to review that appraisal. And so the underwriter is looking at the values, comparing the comparable sales, and essentially doing another review without actually going to the field to see the home. So there was a checks and balance system there.
There was, but was there always a review appraiser? Or I mean, there was always an underwriter, but some appraisals had appraisal review and some didn't, right, in the old days?
Well, a formal review is done by an appraiser, but all appraisals were reviewed by underwriters,
right,
to look for the variances in the product.
But again, just to kind of do a little history here, those underwriters worked for the mortgage companies, so they were under pressure to get loans done. They were under pressure to do as many files as possible, so the quality goes down when the pressure goes up, right?
Yeah.
Potentially. But that reverse auction thing is terrible.
That's the problem.
That's awful.
Yeah. So now we got a system where we're basically getting the least qualified, least busy appraisers. And I don't mean, by the way, to disparage any appraisers listening to this podcast whatsoever.
Especially the lowest bidder.
Well,
or except the lowest bidder, maybe.
But it only makes sense.
Yeah.
That's the person that's going to be available, and that's an issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's an issue. I think appraisals, what I even think I know, because I've been through these market cycles before, where it's really going to become difficult is as we start going through the transition, meaning as home values stop declining and start going back up again, it's going to be a problem because it was easy, of course, when home values were continuing to go up and then you bought something for less because you had a higher comparable. But when you go the transition from the other direction, where now a house is selling for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 more than the previous home, the appraiser's got to know his stuff to be able to justify why somebody's willing to pay that in any given market.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
So is that causing potentially the market in the bubble markets that are collapsing? And most of them have pretty much collapsed now. There's maybe only a little bit more to see come down, I think, in some of these markets. They're not quite at the bottom, but they're getting close. Is that causing the market to decline faster potentially? It seems like that dynamic could be occurring.
It could. It depends on how many short sales and foreclosures you're going to have in a market. The way the appraiser looks at it is, let's just take a given neighborhood, and in a given neighborhood, say that there's 10 sales in that particular neighborhood. If one of those sales is a short sale or one of those sales is a foreclosure, they're told to ignore it. They have to list it. They have to show it as a comparable, but they'll make note that this was a short sale or
an artificially low sale, potentially.
Potentially.
And by the way, we should also, Randy, and you and I both know this, say to the listeners, just because it's a foreclosure or a short sale doesn't mean it's a good deal.
Yeah, that's a real good point.
Haven't you seen foreclosures and short sales that went above the comps that were really overvalued sometimes, because they're bid up and there's multiple, some of these folks, you just need to work with a person with experience, right? That's the bottom line.
When you're out there in the market, you definitely don't want to be overpaying. And it's easy to get caught up in that because a lot of listing agents are taking homes that are REOs, purposely advertising them at a price that they know is way below what it will actually sell for, and then getting buyers to bid them up.
Yeah, so sometimes that auction scenario actually makes it overvalued.
Correct.
But then again, sometimes an auction can be a good deal. It depends. This stuff, there's no hard and fast rules about a lot of it. It just depends.
Well, know your market.
Yeah, know your market and have a professional that's experienced that's going to help you.
The last thing I wanted to say about the current lending environment, and we've talked about this before too, as a prospective buyer, being pre-approved is more important than ever. Well, let's kind of go back on this idea of short sales and foreclosures right now. Most lenders won't even accept an offer unless you have a bona fide pre-approval. Not just an opinion letter from somebody that says, hey, I think this guy's qualified, but they want to have a verify the income, verify the assets, verify the credit, and actually have a bona fide approval from one of the automated underwriting systems. So pre-approval is very important nowadays.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. How long does the pre-approval take? Because these aren't the instant pre-approvals that are like written on a piece of letterhead that's worth the paper it's written on, maybe, that just says, hey, this guy's probably going to qualify for a loan. This is a formal approval.
Formal approval.
How long does that take?
The answer is that the process itself can take an hour, but it depends on the borrower.
How can you verify income in an hour?
Well, that's it. Depends on the borrower providing us with the income and asset documentation. So if we meet with a borrower, they show up with the W-2s, they show up with the tax returns, they show up with the pay stubs and the bank statements, now we can verify that, put accurate data in the system, and within an hour you can have a formal approval.
All right, good.
Makes sense?
So basically, when you talk about the temperature of the lending market today, there's sort of three pillars there. There's disclosures, appraisals, and pre-approvals, all very important for people to understand.
And one more maybe, Jason, which is strict adherence to guidelines. Don't expect favors. Don't expect variations on what is offered.
Right. Maybe that goes under the pre-approval category, but talk to us just for a moment about credit scores, if you would, Randy. Because what I see happening out there is millions and millions, maybe tens of millions, maybe even more than that, of people having their credit damaged. And I see people that are strategically hurting their credit by defaulting intentionally on loans to get loan modifications or just not to pay. I'm hearing stories all the time of people sitting in their houses, haven't paid for a long time, and the lender hasn't even filed a notice of default. It's like a free ride. It just irks me to no end. Credit's getting pretty important, isn't it?
I've always felt that credit is like the cornerstone for this whole process.
And credit score.
Credit score, exactly. And in fact, I guess Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac agreed with me about a year ago when they started doing credit pricing based on credit scores. So depending on the loan to value, the amount of money you're borrowing versus the value of the property and your credit score, you may end up paying 2 or 3 points more for the same rate that somebody would have if they had good credit.
Percentage points on interest or points in loan fees?
On loan fees.
Okay.
So on a $200,000 loan, you could pay $4,000 more than the guy sitting next to you. Same loan to value, same property, but because you didn't have a good credit score and the other person did, you paid $4,000 more in fees.
Like in that example, and I know this just off the top of your head, but what's the difference in the credit score? Like the A-level credit is 720 and above still, right?
740.
740 FICO score.
You have another criteria at 760 and above now.
Whoa, that's for really stellar credit. I remember during the subprime debacle, you could just tell it was a bubble waiting to burst. They were making loans to people with credit scores like at 500, maybe even lower, I don't know. What's the lowest FICO score a person can get a loan with nowadays?
Yeah.
And maybe you're not speaking for all lenders, just your bank, I'm not sure.
Yeah, let me just say in general that if you have a score below 680, it's going to be difficult. And if you have a score below 580, it'll probably be impossible, unless you get an FHA loan.
Then what happens?
Then there's no minimum credit score.
Do you do FHA loans?
We do FHA loans. And you can have literally a zero credit score. You could have no credit, and we'll still give you an FHA loan.
Can you tell us about that? Well, I mean, why?
It's just the policy. FHA is insuring the loans, right? The government's insuring the loans. So this is kind of the irony of it. Again, with FHA.
Didn't we just go through this whole problem?
Jason, we went through it again.
It's like, haven't we learned anything? This is so recent. It's not like ancient history either.
Don't you remember the savings and loan bubble? That was only 8-9 years ago.
It's crazy.
And we'll go through it again. 10 years from today, we'll probably sit down in front of whatever we're doing 10 years from today and interview the same thing. People will forget. Memories are short. So yeah, FHA, with the FHA program, you don't have to have any minimum credit score, and we can still make the financing even with as little as 3.5% down payment.
Wow. Yeah. So it seems like we had the subprime problem. It was time to tighten up on qualifying criteria, get good at qualifying people, vet the borrower well, and in some cases, they're just throwing gasoline on the fire.
Well, and the irony is we need to have stated income loans again for a variety of reasons, not just to make up income per se, but there's a lot of people that have income that just doesn't show up on their tax returns. And they're
drug dealers, money launderers, mafia. No, I'm kidding. Well, I'm not kidding, actually, but that's not the only person. No. Tell us about the real legitimate case when that happens, if you would.
Well, let's talk about a senior citizen, for example, somebody that is withdrawing money from, say, a life insurance policy, and they're taking cash that they put into these life insurance policies and let that money grow and compound. Now when they take it out, that money comes to them because it's a loan. Guess what? Income tax-free is not reported on their income tax return. In your seminars, you talk about refi till you die, right? And the strategy with refi till you die is you can take out $150,000 of equity and not pay taxes on that money. Well, that money's not reported as income, but it certainly is legitimate income, and it's available to the homeowner to spend. But we can't use it to qualify you for a mortgage.
Yeah, you know, that's very true. That makes a lot of sense. Definitely a challenge there. Okay, so what's going on in the world of rates nowadays, and what's your prediction for the future?
Yeah, this is a really good topic. I did this in research for our call today because I wanted to see a couple things. First of all, I have a chart here that we're going to look at, and I'll talk through so the listeners can kind of visualize what we're seeing. But if you look at the chart, the colored blue one I gave you, Jason, this is a chart that shows the history of the long-term U.S. government securities. So we're talking 30-year Treasury bonds, essentially. And this chart, interestingly enough, goes back 217 years. So it's a big sample. Now, you notice I drew some lines on there as we look across this graph that the rate of 3% and 5%, you see the two lines that go across the 3 to 5%?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those lines representing the interest rates on those Treasury bonds represent what the rates were about 80% of the time across 217 years. So let me say that again. Out of a 217-year sample, the 30-year Treasury bond ran between a range of 3 and 5% 80% of those years. Now, if you go up to 8%, in other words, from 3 to 8% range, now we have 90%, the range of 90% of the years are going to fall into that 3 to 8% range. So now I looked yesterday to see what the 30-year Treasury bond was yesterday. And the interest rate, this is October 28th, okay? So October 27th, the rate was 4.29%. Okay. So what I'm pointing out here is if you look back in a big picture right now, we're at 4.29%. We're within that 80% range of Treasury bonds. What's really interesting, if you look to the very end of the graph and look to the area that starts at kind of about 1951 and then goes all the way to about 2001.
Okay.
You see that big spike in interest rates there?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So this is what we remember in terms of interest rates. We remember this hyperinflation or very high rate of inflation.
Which is nothing compared to what other countries have experienced.
That's right. Yeah. Which is another piece of this pie here.
Yeah.
As you look at this, we've had a very stable interest rate environment for 200-year history,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So the question would be, what happened in 1951 that started this upward increase in interest rates? And just what would your perspective on that?
Well, quite a few things. I mean, America really owned the Industrial Revolution for quite a while. We started really abusing monetary policy with the Federal Reserve. Taxes increased. And then in 71, we went off the gold standard. So that was the period where, and then you look at the 70s, that was a disaster.
Well, that's where we have the hugest spike.
Right, yeah. Right?
So basically what I'm showing here is going back into the 50s, which is right after World War II, basically the idea of Cold War, the locking up of trade, the idea that we weren't trading with the world. And the reason I want to bring
I forgot to mention globalization. Left out a minor thing here.
Well, and the point being, we have to make everybody aware of the same idea that could happen again.
Right.
People are talking about protectionism. People are talking about shutting down markets and, you know, holding prices and doing that. You can see what happens when you shut down global markets. then all of a sudden the cost of the goods and services in your local market get jacked up because there's no other places to supply them.
Okay, but what also happens is employment gets better because Americans have jobs because they're not outsourced to China.
Well, okay, so Americans have jobs, right? But then they're going to still not have a fair and level playing field in competition for prices and services, which will drive up the cost of everything.
Okay, so what are you advocating?
Well, what I'm advocating is this. If you hear people, especially politicians, talking about the idea of shutting down markets and protectionism, it's something that you really need to stay away from. We need to have open markets. We need to have free markets where people can trade globally.
Right? Okay.
That's what I'm advocating.
Yeah.
You know what else is real interesting? We'll get off this chart. If you look at 9/11, the last little number on there, 9/11, we were still at interest rates that were about the same as they were in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see right after 9/11 is where all the interest rates crashed.
Precipitous decline, sure.
Yeah. Big precipitous decline.
Right.
So with that, let's switch to this other chart. Now, this is a much more narrow look at interest rates, but I'm still going back 2 years. Okay. So what I wanted to do is get a sense of what's really gone on over the last 2 years. So I'm going to start with, again, today, and this is, again, broad-based, but this is what the interest rates would be for an owner-occupied 30-year fixed-rate loan.
Thank you for listening to the Creating Wealth Show. This is Jason Hartman, your host, and we appreciate you following the show. We have many, many episodes, hundreds of episodes, and some of the older episodes have been archived and placed in our members section, and that applies to this one. So we include a sample that's about 25 minutes long, and then for the rest of the show, you can go to our members section at jasonhartman.com. Many of the other shows are still in their full-length, complete version. However, some of the shows, like this one, are in our members section where you can hear the show in its entirety. And again, you just need to go to jasonhartman.com and you can get the full show there in the members section, plus a whole bunch of other great members benefits and resources, whether it be documents, forms, contracts, articles, other video and audio content, just a great resource. So be sure to join as a member at jasonhartman.com. And thanks again for listening to the Creating Wealth Show.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.